Well, let us begin. We are a little bit late. This is the last lecture I have in this week, and it's the last one I have altogether, except for the one tonight, which will deal with the Spanish poet Jorge Guillén and his place in modern European poetry. Nietzsche, the German philosopher Nietzsche, once said that in every man there is a child that wants to play. And my question is, why suppress it? Why suppress it, if this is really true, and I think it is? I think the puppet show last night, you know, proved exactly Nietzsche's point, and I think held my point too, that there is this tremendous potential, the potential of really of creativity, of imagination, and spontaneity, and somewhere in the process of growing up. You don't just grow up in size and understanding, but you conform to the non-creative, the non-spontaneous, and in a way you really lose your soul for the bread. You know, man does not live by bread alone. You can kind of interpret that in many ways. I would say that man does not live by bread alone, he needs poetry too. And by poetry I mean the poetry as an expression of the spontaneous, of a kind of creative engagement with reality. And to give you one more quote, Baudelaire, the French poet, the great French poet of the 19th century, was influenced T.S. Eliot and quite a few modern movements of the 20th century. Baudelaire once exclaimed, he said that every healthy man can do without food for 2 days, but without poetry, never. Now, what Baudelaire meant, of course, is not, if I understand him correctly, not have to read, you know, everyday poetry, far from it. But what he meant is that you really cannot do for 2 days without a living, creative encounter with reality, without transforming it by your imagination. In this sense, I think he's right, that once you really begin to live intensely and creatively, 2 days not to do it is really much, much worse than to stay without food. Poetry is an invitation not just to cleanse the windows of your senses and your sensibility that lead to your innermost being, but it's really to open them wide and to keep them that way as much as possible. Now, some new haikus have been handed in, and I'd like to read them to you. The first one, I sit upon a large rock, thinking deep thoughts. I should have a cushion. The gnarled roots enslave the eye to watch each step. The hummingbird surveys the meadow of flowers. I don't quite get the transition here. Hummingbird dive bombing. Briefly the fly too saw glory in the sky. The insurmountable wall of a bathtub must be Kierkegaard's despair to the ant. Switches freeing the current for light. Blackout panic. The warmth and glow of one stubby candle. Sauna heat, burned seat, pores of body and mind. Open. Well, this is all I have, and I hope that when I leave, you will continue to write these, and perhaps even more so, because the teacher will be gone, you know, and really fun begins. That would be the nicest thing I could really leave with you, is that it is not kind of a closed kind of little episode, but that it really kind of fascinates you and kind of intrigues you to go on your own. Now, I would like to conclude a few remarks on McGill before I move on to the modern European poetry. I read to you this one quote, which I think is a very good summary of what he tries to say on page 30 and 31 last time. And I would like to add a few more here. He says, "The temptation towards spiritual pride in a Christian therefore always involves the evasion or suppression of flesh." And according to McGill, this is a very wrong attitude indeed, because faith to him is confidence in God as the Lord of the here and the now, as the one who became our flesh, who sustains our flesh, and who graces our flesh so that he may finally glorify us in the flesh. Faith, therefore, gives men the freedom to be what they are, concrete, mortal creatures, openly engaged with the world, assured that in that condition God gives his life to them, and in that condition they are called to give their lives to each other. And the most surprising thing may be perhaps the conclusion to this opening chapter, page 36. Because, of course, we have accepted always poets who are openly or professedly Christian. We have accepted religious novels or plays that deal with religious themes. Now, the new thing that McGill introduces, and which is so very refreshing, is that, and I quote, "Both in this service of freeing from this temptation and of making him aware of the world of immediate experience in the flesh, in the senses, both in this service and in the recovery of immediate experience, the Christian community is not primarily interested in poetry by Christian believers about their Christian experiences. If verse is written by such persons, as occasionally it is, all well and good. But in terms of a constant tendency of Christians to evade rather than to celebrate their existence as flesh, what is needed is good poetry, fresh and vigorous poetry, whoever the author and whatever his personal religion." I read that conclusion again. "What is needed is good poetry, fresh and vigorous poetry, whoever the author and whatever his personal religion." Now, that explains why we enjoy the haiku so much. Although they come from the East, they come from a Zen Buddhist background, and yet we delight in them, and justly so. "What a Christian seeks is the actuality of immediate experience, and for that he may find the works of an unbelieving pagan far more effective than anything written by his fellow Christians." Amen. "He has a legitimate interest in poetry as such." He has a legitimate interest in poetry as such, in the power of its rhythms and in the freshness of its metaphors. He does not have to concern himself with the private religion of its author or the topical relevance of its subject matter. Unless that's all the poem is about. You know, if the poem is one really of teaching or preaching or propaganda, then of course you have to take issue. And if the poem stands or falls, you know, by your acceptance or sympathy with an abstract argument or an attempt to kind of persuade you one way or the other, then of course you have to, you know, say, no, I don't agree with this kind of an interpretation of this kind of a thought. But you really can have poetry that issues from a Buddhist, from a Catholic, from an agnostic, and yet if it is a poetry of immediate, concrete experience, as McGill says, it will have relevance to your situation, to your life as a human being in the here and the now. Unless you interpret Christianity as an otherworldly religion, as a constant kind of squinting to the beyond and overlooking the reality right here. "He does not have to concern himself," continues McGill, "with the private religion of its author or the topical relevance of its subject matter. Even 6 lines on the waning moon, or on a hummingbird here in these poems, or sitting on the rock and thinking deep thoughts, can recall him to his perceptual life in the flesh." You need a cushion. Right? Now, this introductory chapter by McGill is followed by 3 analyses. One is of T.S. Eliot, second one of Robert Frost, and the third of Wallace Stevens. And both T.S. Eliot and Robert Frost are probably quite well known to you, but still I would advise you to read these chapters because very, very refreshing. Wallace Stevens emerges perhaps as the real hero of the book, and will be a surprise to many of you, because this New England poet, who was considered, or is considered by many as being rather obscure and precious in his expression, really has quite something to say to us today. Now the interesting thing is in the chapter on T.S. Eliot that McGill says that the early Eliot is much more interesting for Christians than the late Eliot, who became openly and confessedly Christian, and who wrote, you know, Murder in the Cathedral and The Cocktail Party, and even his four quartets evoke Christian imagery strongly. And he analyzes primarily the wasteland, and he analyzes it in terms of city speech. What he sees in T.S. Eliot is that he not only took the city as a subject matter, the grayness, the dullness, the chaos, the oppressiveness of the city as a subject matter of poetry, but he also let the city speech rhythms into his very language. It wouldn't be enough, you see, to describe just subject matter in the old Victorian fashion. To really evoke the city, you have to evoke it with metaphors and with speech rhythms that are jerky and nervous and sometimes just plain silly, as it is in the city. And that's what T.S. Eliot does. So the tremendous revolution that took place in English poetry with The Wasteland in the 20s and the other poems by Eliot and Pound was this kind of doing away with an outworn mode of expression, kind of connecting again poetry with actual immediate experience in the city, and connecting up poetry also with the living language of the city. The interesting thing in this early poem, says McGill, is that T.S. Eliot describes a world of suffering, of unrelieved suffering in the city. The meaninglessness, the isolation, the inability to reach the other. And yet he does not pass judgment. He just opens himself, his poem, in its subject matter, in its language. He opens it with his compassion and makes us suffer through the poem, with the poem, but he does not give or pass judgment and say, well, really, what you need is, you know, the Christian faith. I mean, I'll go to a church, go to Sunday school, and the suffering will be relieved. He doesn't do that. But through his compassion, kind of just going to the very bitter end, he kind of may open the door to a possible reconciliation. But he doesn't do it in Wasteland. And then, in connection with this chapter, of course, he has the possibility to point out how remote often the preaching and the theology of our day is from this, the society, the city, and the suffering of today. And that so often preachers feel that they are in the city all right, but they are like missionaries in the Congo, you know. In other words, they really know the right way and the right rules, and the poor people in the city just don't know it. All you have to do is teach them it. Well, it's not enough to teach. You have really lived, you really have to enter into this chaos in order to emerge victorious, or you just perish with them. The second chapter, and I just have kind of very summary, I just would like to whet your appetite if I can a little bit. The second chapter is concerned with Robert Frost. And here McGill, as some of the best critics of Frost, points out that Frost has been made into a big granddaddy, a kind of Father Christmas, you know, of American literature, and he isn't that at all. He does resort to country speech, as McGill says. He says, really, in the city, I mean, why should you in the city have only the modern kind of consciousness? It must be everywhere present, and maybe you need the perspective of the countryside to see, really, visualize the modern problems. And so he says, really, whether you live somewhere in New England, in a small village, or whether you live in New York or in Chicago, really doesn't matter. If you're sensitive enough, open enough, you will see the fundamental realities of man. And this fundamental reality is a tragic one. Frost agrees too. And so, in almost every of his major poems, there is always this kind of a two-foldedness of reality presented. There is never, I mean, sheer happiness or exuberance. There is always the worm in the fruit. There is always the shadow that falls from a blossoming tree. And this is what Frost brings out in his poetry. Now, he believes that it is very important to return to kind of an organic understanding of life. As he says, I mean, you follow the grain of the wood, really, to make it into a tool, and you don't go against the grain of it. And so there's great wisdom in country folk who follow the seasons, who kind of really test everything, I mean, before they finally really go ahead with it. Whereas you have in the city, people in the city kind of a feeling that really you owe the world, and you can dictate, and you can mold it, and you can change it, you know, and you can break it any way you please. And out of this comes a tremendous unhappiness, because there's really no shelter, there is no community, because between man and the outer world, it's only a domination, and domination makes you miserable. Frost says, submit in order really to be part and victorious. And he speaks about these things in a way that never really comes out and, you know, openly begins to preach. In his worst poems, he does, especially in his later poems, with McGill. But the finest poems, Robert Frost, he characterizes with restraint, that they hint and allude to things, but they let the reader kind of think, like a good haiku, you know. It reverberates in his mind, it's a seed planted, but the final conclusions are left to you. Sometimes it can be irritating, you know, it can be ambiguous, but usually it is not that. It is suggestive, it is open, and so it respects the reader and his independence and does not simply say what Frost wants the world to be or how he sees it. So this restraint of wisdom, the restraint that comes in a person who lives with nature and with the seasons and with country people, and who respects the other instead of merely kind of grating upon the other or rejecting him in order to elevate your own ego the higher. The third poet is Wallace Stevens, and in Wallace Stevens, McGill discovers not the kind of the pithiness of country speech or the nervousness of city speech, but really an altogether different speech, what he calls artificial speech. I don't like that term artificial very much. What he means is that Wallace Stevens says, really, the poet, when he sees all of reality, when he celebrates the unity of being, then he really cannot listen to the spoken voice of the day. But he must, in order to celebrate, create a language that kind of lifts you out of the everyday prose existence. Now, both Frost, from his country point of view, and Eliot, from his city dweller's point of view, say the spoken language is the norm through which you enter into the modern reality. Wallace Stevens says, we have too much of the spoken, you know, speech with us. It comes everywhere, on the radio, the newspapers, and so forth. What man is longing for is a transformation of reality. He wants to see glimpses of another reality penetrating this reality around us here. And so he celebrates the moments of transfiguration, almost, of reality, you can say. Now, this sounds very mystical, but it isn't mystical in Stevens. He says, if you really have your eyes open, you'll see that here and there, really, moments of fulfillment happen. Right here in Holden, I mean, it's not a constant chain of moments of fulfillment, but there are individual moments that can come about on a hike, even while eating your lunch. But of course, if you are in an exceptional kind of situation, you are ready for it because you expect, you see, something extraordinary to happen. What happens when you go on a city street, you know, when you walk down Central Park or somewhere? Nothing happens, see? because you are in the routine, you are all kind of enmeshed in the prose of the everyday. But Wallace Stevens says, unless you can make kind of meaningful this experience, unless you can find moments of transfiguration, even there, even on a dirty, dusty street, just looking at a stray cat, and seeing an inscape, what Hopkins say, in that stray cat, you know, you will just perish. You will just perish. Because you will feel that the city is a jungle. It's a jungle of stone. It's a desert of stone and dust. Unless you can find these creative moments, when you open a window and suddenly a curtain flutters in the breeze, or you see a girl running across in a beautiful red skirt, and suddenly, I mean, you will feel, I mean, that there is, even amidst this routine, I mean, there is a moment of fulfillment where it seems almost like another reality breaks into this reality, says Wallace Stevens. McGill says on page 174, Wallace Stevens celebrates those moments when the visible is exalted by a peculiar intensity from beyond. Now, he doesn't mean beyond in the Christian sense here, but he means, I mean, it's a spiritual, metaphysical kind of intensity that suddenly kind of breaks through and makes the solid, the physical, light and airy and almost transparent. A haiku poet would say, the particular, concrete reality becomes symbolical. The universal kind of shines through. He teaches men to recognize the paradise that comes to them in the here and the now. Glimpses of Eden. Of course, you can't be all the time in this. But you can discipline yourself, you can become attentive to these moments, and really be thankful for them. Wallace Stevens himself says once, the poet is the priest of the invisible. Now there again, you must get away from your Christian connotations. It doesn't mean that he's the priest of the invisible, you know, reality, beyond reality. But what he means, that the poet's task is not to describe the physical, the static, but to transform it into a dynamic encounter, to transfigure it, and to point out these moments when the physical becomes transparent to this kind of a metaphysical reality. Now Stevens himself disclaims he's a Christian, and goes on to make out of these moments of fulfillment a kind of a philosophy, and say this is really all there is. Now, we don't have to follow that. But as Christians, you know, I mean, it's very important to see reality, as Hopkins says, charged with the grandeur of God. That reality is really a revelation of God's glory, or I guess, yes, his creation. You know. You must be able to see that, otherwise you'll live in a trap. Let me just read you one poem by Wallace Stevens of one such moment. The house was quiet and the world was calm. The house was quiet and the world was calm. The reader became the book, and summer night was like the conscious being of the book. The house was quiet, and the world was calm. The words were spoken as if there was no book, except that the reader leaned above the page, wanted to lean, wanted much, most to be the scholar to whom his book is true, to whom the summer night is like a perfection of thought. The house was quiet because it had to be. The quiet was part of the meaning, part of the mind, the access of perfection to the page. And the world was calm, the truth in a calm world in which there is no other meaning. Itself is calm. Itself is summer and night. Itself is a reader leaning late and reading there. Now, Stevens is not denying the dramatic tensions of reality. He's not denying war and evil. But he says, even amidst war and evil and in the grayness of the city, if you are really honest and sensitive and attentive, you will have these glimpses of fulfillment, of a transfiguration of reality. Or as a Japanese poet would say, there's a haiku everywhere. Or as Hopkins would say, there is Inscape all around you, but you're blind to it. And the Bible talks all the time about this, you know, that we just don't see. We have eyes, but we don't see. We have ears, we don't hear. What does it mean? To me, it means simply that really, man rebels against his humanity, against his creatureliness, and part of it is that he should be open to God's creation. He withdraws into himself and shuts all the windows and the doors, you know, and then he just suffocates inside. But he's proud. There he is, suffocating like in a room, you know. You just don't open any little crack because you want to preserve, I mean, your own self in there. So you have ears, you have eyes, but you don't really live. You're dead. But you're proud and you're independent and you're alone. And that's what counts with so many other people. So you see, from Wallace Stevens, again, by implication, one can learn a great deal. Now, this is McGill. Now, after the age of Eliot, and it has been said that the age of Eliot, really, we can call it, from 1920, from the wasteland, to about 1950. It's over now. Eliot was a critic and a poet, and as both, he was extremely effective. An interesting thing is that although Eliot kind of wanted to open himself up to reality, his criticism was an attack upon romanticism. You know, after Eliot and the New Critics, you couldn't enjoy any more Shelley, a little bit of Keats maybe, certainly not Wordsworth anymore. They were all out. The 19th century was out, and the 17th century was in. John Donne and Andrew Marvell, you know, this was a great discovery. And that's marvelous, they discovered them, because they were thought to be artificial and precious and strained, and Eliot and his followers taught us to discover the 17th century, the so-called metaphysical poetry. Well, glory to them for that. But that they, in order to elevate the 17th century, they had to run down the 19th, you know, there had to come a reaction. And the reaction came in the 50s, and it's still very much with us. And I'd like to quote to you from an article that was sent to me by the Arne Mohns, who were here a week ago. They sent me the National Observer, and there is a long article about new poetry in America from the 50s on, where new poetry finds fertile ground. This is from San Francisco. The continuing development here of what practitioners prefer to call the new American poetry is surely one of the major untold stories of our time. That a movement so serious, so vital, and so accomplished should remain, years after its inception, largely unknown to most people and misunderstood by others, is surprising. Comparable post-war developments in the arts, abstract expressionism, black humor, pop art, electronic music, even the underground film, are common knowledge, but not the vast, exciting body of poetry written outside the academic mainstream of American verse. The academic mainstream are the followers of T.S. Eliot, the professor poets, who are also critic poets, and very often are academic in the bad sense of the word, usually classicists. In part, of course, the press is at fault. It has inadvertently associated San Francisco poetry exclusively with the beatniks in the 1950s in the public mind. In A.D. 1966, however, years after the beatniks' noise, there is little excuse for not knowing of the new poetry. It is more vigorous than ever, gaining great strength in its maturity. More poetry is happening in San Francisco, said Irish poet John Montgomery on a recent visit, than any place else in the world. I don't agree with him. Now this is really amazing, that we are not only aware of poetry as such, not aware of American poetry, and not aware of modern poetry happening right now, happening right in your backyard, so to speak, here. These young poets rebel against T.S. Eliot, rebel against New Criticism, rebel against the objective correlate, you know. As Eliot says, poetry must be impersonal to be universal. They say it must be subjective as hell, you know, to quote one of them. It must be subjective, really, personal, suffering, joying, enjoying the world, intensely and personally so. And so they have discovered again romanticism, as this article in the end implies. The worst thing you can say about a poem, one of these poets writes, is that it's dull. Very little of the new poetry is dull. A lot of it is amateurish, faddish, and mystical to the point of obscurity, but not dull. It is poetry that tries, that at least for the moment does not strive to be safe above all. It is poetry that can deal with large, violent emotions as well as mere celebration. We need this kind of poetry, just as we need the other kind. Indeed, each kind needs and is fertilized by the other. And here is one of these poets, perhaps my favorite, Gary Snyder, who has been in Japan for a long time and is deeply influenced by the haikus. Riprap. Lay down these words before your mind like rocks, placed solid by hands in choice of place, set before the body of the mind in space and time. Solidity of bark, leaf, or wall, riprap of things, cobble of Milky Way, straying planets, these poems, people, lost ponies with dragging saddles, and rocky, sure foot trails. The world's like an endless four-dimensional game of Go. Ants and pebbles in the thin loam, each rock a word, a creek-washed stone granite. Ingrained with torment of fire and weight, crystal and sediment linked hot, all change in thoughts as well as things.
That'd be terrific to have him here. That's a great poem for right here.
And, his book, his last book is called Myths and Texts, you see, and this person writing here says that Gary Snyder's poetry, heavily influenced by Oriental forms, is lean and understated in places verging on the Japanese haiku. And I think it's true, you can sense this probably.
That's kind of
yeah. Well, now, modern poetry. You may have people, you know, who don't have to be converted to poetry. They say, I like poetry, but only up to Edna St. Vincent Millay. Because what follows is really madness and chaos and all those San Francisco bad boys. Now, once you really begin to study modern poetry, and I mean modern poetry, 20th century poetry, you'll find that it has a tremendous range and variety, from prose-like free verse to polished esoteric sonnets, from romantic outbursts of violent emotions to kind of very controlled intellectual kind of classicism, from social protest to the withdrawal into solitary contemplation. I think the 20th century, at least the first half of it, will become known as one of the greatest ages of poetry in world literature. And because of this, I don't understand why we should worry so much about the agony of the modern theater, if you read in one of the last Time issues, or the crisis of the novel. Poetry has gone through such arid periods too. Every genre, every art, you know, has its ups and downs, its poems, its periods of flourishing, its periods of decline. But not today, I think, is poetry in such a decline. So I think you should taste and see what is happening in this most original and most creative literary form of today. And don't be afraid to kind of let go as you read it. Quite a bit of it is protest, but the protest against modern reality, you know, this we are top heavy in science and a kind of positivistic approach to things. The protest very often is expressed through humor, through nonsense, through play. And one of the great things of modern art, if it hasn't done anything else, it has discovered one of the primary sources of all art. And that is the element of play, that man is a homo ludens, that he is a player, that man is a laughing animal, As a matter of fact, I mean, says Aristotle, I think, says that that really one should define animal as a laughing, the animal ridens, you know, as a laughing animal, because even some animals play. So you can't say this is exclusively human. You know. But the laughing animal, unless it's a coyote or somebody, you know, we aren't even sure what it's laughing. So I think, remember this, and when you see, I mean, some mad things going on, you know, on the stage or in music or in poetry, it is really a protest, it is a liberation from excessive, you know, systematic kind of approaches to things, to a kind of incrustations of kind of logic, kind of common sense, and kind of realism, and really we feel almost being smothered, you know, by all of this. And so this is why people enjoy so much children, you know. You know, you enjoyed the show last night, but you probably felt like this one program we had once on TV, you know. I mean, kids say the darndest things, you know. I mean, ha ha ha, you know, but really, I mean, I wouldn't, you know, because I'm grown up, you see. So you enjoy it, you see. I mean, say it again, you know. But of course, you are so much above, you wouldn't do it. So really, what you should do is join the kids, you know. Join the kids in their poetry, in their puppeteering, in their drawing, because as Nietzsche says, in every man there is a child and wants to play. And why be ashamed of it? You can sublimate it, you know. Now I wanted to, I wrote yesterday a poem, you know, talking all these, this time, you know, in prose to you. I wanted really to kind of, to sum up what I tried to say here, that the poetry should be a part of everyday life. But it should be consumed, eaten up with salt, and not be adored in a glass case, you know, just on holidays only, as you go to Sundays to the museum, you see, and smile at Mona Lisa, and she smiles back at you. And finally, the poem, once the poem has opened your eyes to the depth of experience, you know, has washed kind of your channels of perception, has opened the windows of your sensibility, you can discard the poem. Because a poem, you see, is not an end in itself, but merely a means of encounter between the reader and the world. It should be transparent, it should make possible this encounter, you know. But the poem is not the end in itself, and some people make, you see, of art, of poetry, an end in itself. And I think this really shouldn't be. It is really a machine to release in you creativity. And so this poem, I hope, won't shock you. I hope it does, yeah. It's called Ars Poetica. And you know, there's so many Ars Poeticas, the art of poetry. Poets are written, poetry should be like a temple, you know, with pillars. It should be like a Gothic cathedral, you know, and so forth. So I try to kind of pull together, as an Estonian, this is my first English translation here. Ars Poetica. A good poem should be like a sock with holes, through which the dry skin can breathe again. A mosquito can quench its thirst for blood. Real dust can freely kiss the foot. A good poem should be like a sock with holes, sometimes smelling of sweat, sometimes of soap, always of wool, cotton, or nylon, comfortably fitting the wearer's verse foot. A good poem should be like a sock with holes, already worn in, completely dependable, that knows how to walk and how to jump in order to get home at last, throwing shoes along with the holy socks into the corner. See, you know, I don't know, I mean, whether this really comes off or not, I wrote it last night. You know, you have to do something like that, you know. I mean, if you say, I mean, poetry is the vocation of beauty, you know, I mean, you know, no one listens to it. But if you say it's a sock full of holes, you know, everybody's shocked, you know. And you say it smells of sweat and of soap, you know, they're even more shocked. But probably you remember it, you know. That is the whole point. The whole point, I mean, is in that. Now, the anthology that I have here, and I have a few minutes left for it, Modern European Poetry. It leaves out, you know, many literatures. And I just hope that you will know, after having been at Holden, that besides French, German, Greek, Italian, Russian, Spanish poets, there are also poets writing in Latvian and Estonian. And that these are not merely some obscure dialects, you know, in the Black Mountains or in the Smokies. For example, modern Finnish poetry isn't in here. And it's really one of the most exciting chapters in modern poetry. Let me just read you one short poem by the enfant terrible of contemporary Finnish poetry, born 1937. His name is Pentti Saarikoski. Life is given to man so that he would seriously ponder in what position he wants to be dead. Gray skies travel above, clusters of stars hang down, and the earth comes right into your mouth like bread. In Finnish, elämää on ihmiselle annettu, jota hän tarkoin harkitsisi, missä asennossa tahto olla kuollut. Harmaita taivaista kulkee yli, tähi tarhoja riippuu, ja maa tulee suuhun kuin leipää. I can see some of the last minute, some of you who heard it speak as money, the relationship of the 100 consonants, 100 vowels, 99 consonants, you know. You see, hardly any clusters of consonants, it's almost like Italian. Now there's no translation of Finnish poetry in here, but we do have German poets, Greek, Russian. Let me just read you one German poet, Günter Grass. He's well known as a novelist. He wrote, The Tin Drum and The Dog Ears. But he's a very fine poet, too. He's a sculptor and a painter, and as a painter he loves to paint nuns. And he had a whole exhibit. He had one exhibit devoted entirely to nuns, you know, and the other ones devoted entirely to cocks. Not the cocks, the cooks. Cooks would be all right too, you know, cooks. The nuns, you know, especially those with big headgear, you know, flapping in the wind on sandy beaches, you know, like black scarecrows, you know, so forth. I mean, tremendous affecting it. All right, Günter Grass. He's also a poet. Just this year came out a first selection of his poetry, and I would like to recommend it very much to you, because one hardly believes that someone can be such a good poet and a good novelist, but Günter Grass is. Folding Chairs, page 181. How sad these changes are. People unscrew the nameplates from the doors, take the saucepan of cabbage and heat it up again in a different place. What sort of furniture is this that advertises departure? People take up their folding chairs and emigrate. Ships laden with homesickness and the urge to vomit carry patented seating contraptions and unpatented owners to and fro. Now on both sides of the great ocean there are folding chairs. How sad these changes are. Another poem by Günter Grass, In the Egg. We live in the egg. We have covered the inside wall of the shell with dirty drawings and the Christian names of our enemies. We are being hatched. Whoever is hatching us is hatching our pencils as well. Set free from the egg one day, at once we shall draw a picture of whoever is hatching us. We assume that we are being hatched. We imagine some good-natured fowl and write school essays about the color and breed of the hen that is hatching us. When shall we break the shell? Our profits inside the egg for a middling salary argue about the period of incubation. They posit a day called X. Out of boredom and genuine need, we have invented incubators. We are much concerned about our offspring inside the egg. We should be glad to recommend our patent to her who looks after us. But we have a roof over our heads. Senile chicks, polyglot embryos, chatter all day and even discuss their dreams. And what if we are not being hatched? If this shell will never break? If our horizon is only that of our scribbles, and always will be, we hope that we are being hatched. Even if we only talk of hatching, there remains the fear that someone outside our shell will feel hungry and crack us into the frying pan with a pinch of salt. What shall we do then, my brethren, inside the egg? Food for prophets. 183, same poet. When the locusts occupied our town, no milk came to the door. The dailies suffocated. Our jails were open to release all prophets. They streamed through the streets, 3,800 prophets, talking and teaching without restriction, and eating their fill of that gray and jumpy mess we call the plague. So everything was fine and up to expectations. Soon our milk came again, our papers reappeared, and prophets filled our jails. Let's move from Germany to Greece. And this was the biggest surprise when a few years ago, Georgos Seferis got the Nobel Prize. People said, what? Are there any Greeks left in Greece? We thought that literature kind of had ended with Homer. Well, there is a very rich tradition of Greek literature. Almost really, it's about the only literature that has had a continuous redevelopment, a tradition of some 3,000 years at least, uninterrupted. And new discoveries might really prolong it further than that. People argue where to place exactly Homer, for example. There are several poets. Of course, Nikos Kazantzakis is known by many of you. I mean, the novelist, who has written The Greek Passion, you know, and Zorba the Greek, the movie. And he was up for a Nobel Prize, but he died before he could get it, you know, before the Swedes could make up their mind. So Seferis got it, who was a diplomat in London, and a translator of T.S. Eliot. I don't think that Seferis really is the best of these poets. My preference goes to Odysseus Elitis on page 214. Now he really captures some of the excess of light that is for me Greece. The tremendous perspectives really back into history. You can almost say that history and the myth kind of merge into a timeless reality of this very intense light, and really the reality of Greece is made up of very few elements: rock, light, and sea. These three, you know, and if you see, I mean, it's on the rocky coast somewhere of Greece, one column standing up, you know, again in this sunlight, it's really all it is. Or as an Austrian poet Hofmannsthal said, all that you need really is one grain of sand, you know, and the sea, and already Greece begins. It is this tremendous reduction to the essential, you know, which the Greeks have always known, the sense of measure, the reduction to the essentials, which the Greeks have and the Japanese. They really, I think, have the finest kind of sense of measure and aesthetic proportion. And I would say also, then from Greece, it went to the Italians, the Spaniards, the French, but the Greeks really have it at its most intense. We won't listen to them, Bell. I mean, you're late. All right. So page 241, drinking the Corinthian sun. Drinking the Corinthian sun, reading the marble ruins, striding over vineyard seas, aiming with my harpoon at votive fish that elude me. I found those leaves which the psalm of the sun memorizes, that living land which desire opens with joy. I drink water, cut fruit, plunge my hands through the wind's foliage. Lemon trees quicken the pollen of summer days. Green birds cut through my dreams. And I leave my eyes filled with a boundless gaze, where the world becomes beautiful again from the beginning, according to the heart's measure. There is another poet who is not in this anthology because there were copyright difficulties, who is the most famous of modern Greek, New Greek poets. His name is Kavafis, Konstantinos Kavafis. And he was an Alexandrian, he lived in Alexandria. And one of his poems is Waiting the Barbarians, Waiting for the Barbarians. Anybody know it? It's a tremendous poem. He describes, I mean, how they have all the dignitaries of the senators and so forth, I mean, are waiting in Rome, you know, for the coming of the barbarians. They're all decked out, you know, and the barbarians had to come. They want to receive them. And stanza after stanza, you know, they all sit and they all wait, and the barbarians don't come. And so the poem ends, you know, this note that the messenger arrives and says there are no barbarians anymore. And so all these Romans, you know, who waited for the end of their world, you know, they said, what are we going to do with our barbarians? Those barbarians would have been some kind of solution. You know? And sometimes I feel, aren't we sitting here, you know, somehow waiting for the Russian barbarians, you know, to do something, you know, to attack us, you know, something, you know, because it might be some kind of solution, you know, but they don't, you know. So here we sit, you know, sit and wait and pile up, you know, more atomic bombs, you know, and they just don't come, you know. And maybe there are no barbarians anymore, I don't know. There would have been some kind of solution. And if they are, don't come, we have really to kind of settle down and try to figure out our own problems. Well, let's turn to Russia, to Andrei Voznesensky, who was here a few months ago. Two books of his have been published in English. This is a Russian poet's impression of New York, of a strange New York bird, on page 462. With moonbeams garlanded, an aluminium bird with fuselage body alights on my window. And above her screw neck, a woman's face flares like a tongue of flame over a gigantic lighter. Tucked in a capitalist sheet, my friend is sound asleep. Who are you, cybernetic delirium, half robot, half spirit, an amalgam of the queen of the blues and the flying saucer? America's soul, perhaps, weary of all the fun? Who are you, teenage chimera, a cigarette stuck in your teeth? But they stare unblinking, and the night cream is not wiped off yet. Those eyes like a certain girl's on Lake Michigan. Such gassy bags she has under her eyes. Bird, what do you prophesy? Tell no lies now, bird. Tell us what you know. A very strange thing from the outside surges up in me as in a connecting vessel. The atomic age moans in the bedroom. I yell! And swearing my roommate as if scalded sits up on the mattress. And I would like to conclude with a Spanish poem. And this is a poet from Peru who died in Paris and is really one of the most moving poets and the most sincere poets in the 20th century. I read to you some time ago the poem, page 506, You People Are Dead, which is a wonderful illustration of what Dr. Wolfson said. I mean, if you can, if this, what do you call it, the spirit of God is taken from man, he can still go on breathing, you know, and living, but he really is dead. I think this is what it describes, what this poem describes. But I would like to read another poem here, and that's on page 508. A man passes with a loaf of bread on his shoulder. And here again the range, from drinking the Corinthian sun, the satire of Günter Grass, you see, to this poet from South America. And you see how differently you can see reality, modern reality, how different poems you can write. But the main test is the sincerity, the honesty, the unflinching kind of confrontation with it. Whether you lament or celebrate really doesn't matter if it is done in a spirit of absolute honesty and kind of fully assuming your humanity. A man passes with a loaf of bread on his shoulder. Am I going thereafter to write about him, my double? Another sits down, scratches himself, removes a louse from his armpit, kills it. What good would it do to talk about psychoanalysis? Another has attacked my chest with a club in his hand. Shall I then discuss Socrates with the doctor? A lame man gives his arm to a little boy. After that, am I going to read André Breton, the father of surrealism? A man shivers with cold, coughs, spits up blood. Will it ever be fitting to allude to my inner soul? Another scratches in the mud for husks and bones. How can I then write about infinity? A mason falls from the roof dies before breakfast. How then can I launch a new metaphor or rhythm? A storekeeper cheats a customer of 1 gram. How then can I talk about the fourth dimension? A banker falsifies his accounts. What tears are then left for the theater? A cripple sleeps with 1 foot on his shoulder. Shall I later on talk about Picasso, of all people? Someone sobs at the side of a grave. How can I consider my admission to the academy? A man cleans his rifle in the kitchen. What good would it do to talk more about it? Someone walks by counting his fingers. How can I think of the not me without crying aloud? And perhaps, let's conclude the poem on page 509. When I begin reading Vallejo, I just can't stop usually. This is a puzzling poem because it's an enumeration of particulars of existence, you know. And he doesn't even try really to combine them. It's an association, it's a flow, but it is a particular. It's the bitter, it is the sharp, it is the warm, but it's always the concrete, it's the immediate, it's what hurts and what really gives pleasure. Peace, the wasp, the bung, the hillsides, the dead man, the 10-liter bottles, the owl, places, the spider, the tombs, the tumbler, the dark women, unknowing, the kettle, the acolyte, drops, forgetfulness, power, the cousins, the archangel, the needle, the parish priests, ebony, lack of skill, the part, the type, the stupor, the soul. Easy to handle, covered with saffron, everlasting, spotless. Easy to carry, old, 13. Covered with blood. They have been photographed, made ready. They have swollen up, joined together, broad. They have put on ribbons. They are perfidious. Burning, comparing, living, flying in a rage, striking, analyzing, listening, meddling, dying, bearing up, getting themselves a place, weeping. After these here, after up above, perhaps, while behind, so much, so never, below, maybe, far, always. That one, tomorrow, how much? The horrible, the sumptuary, the very slow, the portly, the fruitless, the ill-fated, causing us to twitch, the wet, the fatal, the awe, the most pure, the gloomy, the bitter, the satanic, the tactile, the profound. Well, if you have any questions, we can